Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Hello, everybody. Sorry to interrupt your reverie, but I wanted to give a little introduction to this week's episode of We've Got Mail. It turns out Whitney's recording was off, so he's going to sound a little weird and echoey. I think I was able to save the episode, but if it sounds weird, that's why, and sorry about that, and we'll try to make sure it won't happen again, because we don't want it to happen again, but we also wanted to make sure that you got our real extemporaneous responses to your various correspondence. So thank you again, thank you for joining us, and we hope you enjoy the episode of We've Got Mail that we're doing now. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. Gosh darn it, I'm a critic, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
Gosh darn it, me too. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a senior staff writer over at Slash Film. I write about Star Trek an awful lot, and for the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool, although you needn't. You don't have to if you don't want to.
But you should. I'm firmly in the call Whitney Rockmeister McCool camp, and indeed a lot of our listeners are. Here's how this podcast works. We do a lot of podcasts here at the Critically Acclaimed Network, and at the end of every single one of them, we encourage you to write to us if you are so inclined. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us an actual physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And we actually get quite a bit of correspondence here at the Critically Acclaimed Network, and I really wish we had more time to just do this show. Sometimes I think we could do this and nothing else. But we're going to get to as many letters as we can. And as always, we like to start with the people who took the time, who took the bother to write us a piece of physical mail correspondence and actually send it to our P.O. box, and we have a few of those. So, Whitney, indeed, why don't you kick us off?
I will indeed. Here is a postcard from C.W., not the C.W., but somebody calling themselves C.W., and it is a postcard of someone dressed up like an Academy Award statuette, and their heart is attached to some ghoulish-looking medical tubes. And there is kind of a cadaverous-looking man in a suit looking over this experimented-upon Oscar man.
Good stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a good kind of... And it's, like, clearly from some sort of live theater event, so it's, like, weird Lovecraftian or H.R. Gigerian image, I suppose. The postcard reads, Hi, Only the Best, that's one of our podcasts, is about the best movies nominated at the Academy Awards, but what about ranking the Academy Awards themselves? Ooh. Are the old broadcasts even preserved somewhere, or are they themselves lost media? CW. P.S. The photo is from On Cinema at the Cinema.
Oh, good to know. Yeah. We were wondering. Is that the whole postcard?
That's a whole postcard.
Okay, well, thank you for writing in. That is a great question. And the answer is they're not archived as well as they should be. I feel like they should be readily available, like on the Academy Awards website. It's very easy to find clips. And maybe there are bootlegs of whole ceremonies. But to the best of my knowledge, there is no one, at least legal, place where you can go to witness all of the recorded ceremonies. A lot of them were from the early years were not recorded because their television wasn't really feasible yet. People didn't have the technology existed, but people just didn't have the TVs. So to the answer to that question, I honestly have seen very few. I think I've seen every single Academy Awards ceremony since I've been alive. At least I can remember.
First watching them, I kind of like walked in and out of the room while my parents watched the Academy Awards when I was a little kid. I remember seeing the first one I really like remember seeing was the year The Last Emperor was nominated for Best Picture. I think it was 87.
Around there, yeah. Yeah, late 80s.
Yeah. And I remember seeing clips of, because the only part I really paid attention to was like Best Visual Effects, because those were the only movies I kind of watched as a kid or at least was familiar with. So I remember seeing, I always liked seeing films like RoboCop dissected very briefly. The clips were only like maybe like 5 to 7 seconds, but you could see like Phil Tippett doing the animation on the Ed 209 in RoboCop and or like a green screen effect. And that was always really fascinating to me.
Yeah, I feel like they used to have a lot more like montages. They used to have a lot more sort of special performances, and I feel like that was often where they would put sort of tributes to more mainstream cinema. Which again, people have argued for a while now that the Academy is out of touch, that they're not rewarding the movies that everyone in the audience likes and or seen, rather, considering a lot of people only see the most mainstream films, the blockbusters, and there's a nugget of truth to that, but honestly, it's not their job to validate blockbusters. It's not even their job to validate good cinema. It's a popularity contest. But they did used to try to make room in that capacity, even if RoboCop wasn't up for Best Picture, you know?
Yeah. And we've talked about this before, but how, they say, oh, it's not the Academy Awards' job to reward blockbusters, but there was a while when that's what they were doing. It's just that what is considered a blockbuster, what, you know, the big mainstream hits, changed. And I think the Academy continued to reward a very similar kind of movie.
Yeah.
There were a lot of, like, you know, the big sort of big Hollywood dramas and prestige pictures. Those used to be the hits.
Yeah. Kramer versus Kramer was a hit. Rain Man was the highest grossing movie of the year it came out.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I feel like the Academy has stayed pretty steady. It's just that people's tastes have changed and what's making huge amounts of money is now changing. And some people feel that the Academy needs to reflect that for some reason, as if the Academy Awards are meant to, yeah, just give an award to whatever we need to remember was most popular that year. We don't need to do that. It's already popular. No, that's its prize.
I think we should be giving more awards to sawdust than mildew.
Yes.
Anyone get that? Anyone get that at home? Okay. In Naked Gun 33.5, there was a sequence that was set at the Academy Awards, and inside the Best Picture envelope, there was an explosive device, and they made this joke about how, funnily enough, all of the nominees were a box office hit except one. And that one was called Sawdust and Mildew. And then when Frank Drebin came on and grabbed it and looked inside and said, "It's the bomb!" Everyone from Sawdust and Mildew was like, "Yes, we won!" So Sawdust and Mildew was like the Hurt Locker of its fictional year. It's the movie that everyone loved but didn't make money. I love the Academy Awards as like an element of history. I like actually like looking back, researching them, seeing the movies that they have put out for posterity. And over on our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, we do have an ongoing series in which we're reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. And it's honestly more exciting to me to watch the films that didn't win and have been lost to history. Because almost every year there's at least a couple of films that, like, we've seen it. You know? Like, that's a classic. Everyone knows it. I've either seen it or I know I need to see it. But also almost every year there's at least one or two films where it's just like, nobody talks about that anymore. That has practically gone to history. And I think it's actually like more important that those make it on the books, because otherwise they would be forgotten, like almost completely. Yeah. I think it was George R.R. Martin who had a line. He said that popular things don't need awards. Their reward is that they're popular.
Yeah.
You know, the gold statue won't validate anything. It's just more accolades to that thing everybody likes. So, but in any case, back to the point at hand, I really wish there were more full Academy Awards ceremonies that were readily available. I think it'd be really fascinating to watch. I don't know if there's like a home video market for that, but I do feel like the Academy could put that out on their website. And even if they just, you know what they could do, because everyone loves this, they could have like an online, like a streamer, like 24 hours a day. They're just showing random Oscar telecasts, maybe in order. So you just go to the website and then, oh, it's Star Wars not winning Best Picture in 1977, or it's here's Jack Palance doing his one-arm push-ups. You know, that'd be a lot of fun.
I know a lot of those sort of highlights, like, you know, Jack Palance doing the one-armed push-ups, or the streaker who ran behind David Niven. Like, all of those are easily found, the more notorious moments, or some of the bigger thank you speeches. I know here in Los Angeles there's the Academy Museum, and I think all of the telecasts are probably archived there. Whether or not they're going to put them up for public consumption remains to be seen. I don't know if it's a commercial thing, or maybe it's like, here's my assumption. Nobody wants to watch the old Academy Awards ceremonies because it's going to be a lot like watching old Saturday Night Live episodes. By which I mean, they're not good. They're not... Look, everyone says, you know, when was the best era of Saturday Night Live? It was when you were watching it in high school. That's probably it.
They used to show those on E! Entertainment Network before they had like 24 hours of content. They would just show old episodes of Saturday Night Live, and what I love about them was, like, especially, they would show, like, the 70s ones, and a lot of those were just not even comedy. It was just people hanging out, talking in weird voices for a bit, and I can't find the joke anywhere. It's just kind of like we're hanging out with these comedians, and I guess there's an appeal to that, but they weren't these high-concept bits. The ones that we remember are the high-concept bits, and also, so many of the jokes, especially in like the cold opens, are so topical that like a month later, you don't remember what the joke was, let alone 40 years.
I don't know if you ever had the experience of trying to watch an entire episode of Saturday Night Live from beginning to end live.
Yeah.
Because it starts pretty late in the night and then it goes on for like 3.5 days. It just goes on and on and on. And the commercial breaks get longer, and as the show goes on, like, it falls off real quick. Like, maybe there's a few bangers, like, near in the first third.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing really hilarious thereafter.
Everything after Weekend Update is, like, was in there, like, their filler box. Like, we'll just, if we have time, we'll do it. Yeah.
And I'm not referring to Saturday Night Live today. I'm talking about in perpetuity. It was always that way.
Yeah.
It always just was death. Like, 2/3 to 3/4 of every single episode was just complete boring death. So I think, and you go back to watch them, and then just you understand, wait a minute, why did we... There's like, you pick and choose the best sketches, and I'm guessing that's the same with the Academy Awards. Mm. You're going to find the few moments that you want to see, but actually watching an entire Academy Awards telecast from a year from the past is probably not going to be very exciting for most people.
Well,
except for, like, you know, awards junkies like us who talk about the Academy Awards every year.
To be fair, that's actually a not insignificant number of people, awards junkies. Think about how many people talk about, like, nothing but the Academy Awards for, like, 5 or 6 months out of the year, because that's what the industry revolves around. So I don't think there's a huge audience for it, but I think there would be enough of an audience to justify, excuse me, maybe not, like, cleaning them up all real nice, you know, and spending, like, remastering them in 4K. But I think there's enough of an audience to actually put them online. I don't know, maybe that's just me. Excuse me. I always veer on the side of wanting things to be available.
Yeah,
you know, even if no one gives a shit, I want them to be around in case someone does.
Yeah. We have some other letters here.
Yeah. Thank you for writing in. That was great.
This one comes in an envelope. I'm going to put it near the crinkle it plenty so you can hear that I'm actually opening the envelope. And this is a letter written on just a little note card. And it's from Anthony. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, Anthony.
It says, Dear Bibbs and Whitney, by the time you read this, the great rap diss war of the 21st century between Kendrick Lamar and Drake may or may not be over. speaking of things that are going to be dated instantly, like, you listen to this episode like 3 months' time, nobody's going to remember the Kendrick Lamar Drake.
I think some people are going to remember how smoked Drake got by Kendrick Lamar. I think this will be written in the annals of music history, but anyway.
And I'm not going to say Drake deserves it, but I do like seeing Drake take the lumps just because his music is so bleeding obnoxious. Anyway, this historical rap beef had me think, is there something similar in the film world? Oh, sir.
Oh, yes.
For example, rivals in the same genre. If James Cameron had a beef with Denis Villeneuve and they used their movies to bust personal dirt, defamation, etc. on each other, and people watched this series of diss movies to learn about their feud. Sincerely, Anthony Ray. Well, let me point you to two Hollywood stars that you might have heard about, named Betty Davis and Joan Crawford.
Oh my God, they hated each other's guts.
They hated each other. They made public, really catty public comments about each other just in, interviews. But they would also, stick it to each other in the movies they were in somehow. They weren't in a lot of movies together.
No,
but,
no. Legendary they whenever they were, though.
Yeah. In fact, it was such a legendary feud that there was a TV show called Feud, all about it. Mm-hmm. The Betty Davis versus Joan Crawford feud. Let's see. There was some talk among fans, not like it wasn't actually going to be put into production, but a lot of people wanted to see a episode of that TV show Feud with Quentin Tarantino and Spike Lee. That would have been really interesting.
Oh God, yeah, that was a big.
They've
deal.
Kind of they've butted heads a lot.
Yeah, Quentin Tarantino was had a cameo, and I think it was in Girl 6, and they got in a fight over Quentin Tarantino's pervasive use of the N-word in his movies, which Spike Lee took issue with, and. Whew, that apparently was kind of a big to-do.
I would love to see that, dramatized. Like somebody script that and find actors to play the filmmakers.
I feel like there was definitely some sort of beef tracks out there, even before people knew about it, with Harvey Weinstein. If you see Scream 3 again, after everything that came out with Harvey Weinstein, it is abundantly clear that movie is about Harvey Weinstein and that Lance Henriksen is playing Harvey Weinstein. and indeed, that all of the horror that befell everybody in the Scream series was a direct result of the real life, not on screen, the real life evils of Hollywood, and how incredibly sexist and gross and exploitative and criminal it could be. So there's one there. On a more lighthearted note, or at least more, I don't know how lighthearted it is, but Debbie Reynolds and Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they had a whole that was a romantic beef, but by God, was it a big one. I don't recall Debbie Reynolds doing any diss tracks. Maybe I need to re-listen to Tammy and see if that's maybe got some digs. Olivia de Havilland and Joan Fontaine, they were sisters.
They were sisters
and they hated each other. Yeah. Oh my God, they were nominated for Oscars the same year.
So there's a lot of those kinds of things, and if you look into not just the movies that they made or starred in, but if you can get interviews with them, you'll probably see and hear a lot of the same kind of thing you're hearing with Drake and Kendrick right now.
I forgot the ultimate cinematic diss track.
Oh?
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane is a diss track against William Randolph Hearst.
Yes.
And William Randolph Hearst wrote, refused advertising for Citizen Kane, from what I understand.
Yep.
Tried to get it destroyed, but it would have been wonderful to see a really transparent effort on William Randolph Hearst's part to personally defame Orson Welles. Write an article about how, he was this horrible criminal.
It's weird that he didn't, actually. Because he did everything else.
You would think you would do that, but no, that sort of thing never happened with Citizen Kane.
It
was a little bit more structured than that.
No, William Randolph Hearst, he refused, and he owned most of the newspapers, so Citizen Kane got almost no advertising, which is one of the reasons why it was not a success when it came out. It was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, it won for screenplay, but it was not huge. Everyone in the industry was actually pretty mad at Orson Welles, as I understand it, because he really poked the bear. like everything from like the name Rosebud was a reference to a pet name that William Randolph Hearst had for his mistress's anatomy. And boy, man, that's I'm not saying William Randolph Hearst doesn't deserve to get taken down many pegs, but that's a low blow. That was pretty harsh.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's definitely an all-timer. But yeah, I know if anyone can think of any others, especially if there were like movies that they made to defame or make fun of each other when there was legit beef. I'm not talking about like, you know, I don't think Mel Brooks is anything against George Lucas when he made Spaceballs.
Right.
I don't think
right.
so like, anyway, you know?
It's hard to think of a parody that's just like outwardly hateful to the thing it's satirizing.
Well, the ones that are tend to not be very good.
A specific movie.
Well, like you look at like, I mean, I would argue that Team America: World Police is really, really angry at the sort of the Jerry Bruckheimer sort of way.
Yeah.
And it was originally going to be specifically mocking the movie The Day After Tomorrow. The original pitch for Team America, which is this blockbustery kind of story, but all told with marionettes, and that was the joke. The original pitch was, we're literally just going to remake The Day After Tomorrow, which had just come out.
With the same script. Yeah, it was a brand new movie.
Yeah, but we're going
to
use the same... Because the script was so bad. The script was
yeah.
so bad, if we do it with puppets, it's going to be hilarious. And they're probably right about that, but apparently, I don't know if they changed their mind or if someone told them to change their ways, but there's a song in Team America World Police that's literally about how much Michael Bay sucks.
Specifically, the movie Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
It's about the movie Pearl Harbor.
But they call out Michael Bay specifically. They even say, why does Michael Bay get to keep on making movies? That's... I don't know if they were mad at him or just thought he sucked, but that one was actually calling their shot, so... anyway, if anyone can think of any examples, especially older examples, we'd love to hear them. Feel free to email us in the future. I'd be very curious. What, we got one other physical letter, I think?
One more physical letter. I'm going to crinkle some more here. Curiously, we got two letters from two different parts of the country, but they came in the exact same sized envelope.
So an envelope is what we're talking about.
Well, it's not like letter standard envelope. Mm. Ooh, this letter comes on several little pages of a notepad.
Okay.
And it's a lovely notepad that that it has a trans pride flag at the top, and it says the trans agenda.
Okay.
It's like for your notepad.
Yeah, because my agenda for the day is boom, 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 boom. That's good. I like that.
And this one comes from Pax. Hello, Pax.
Hey, Pax.
It says, greeting Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. I'm going to use this paper letter to shamelessly ask for a very specific movie recommendations on behalf of me and my partner. We have started to watch more movies together in the evening. My partner has a stressful job, so she understandably does not want to spend her free time watching anything dark or depressing. Mm-hmm. I have a great job, the kind that allows me to listen to lots of movie review podcasts while working, so I'm generally in the mood to watch anything. Recently, she's been in the mood for heist stories, archaeology, and madcap mysteries. She says that in an ideal world, she would just watch National Treasure over and over again. Well, I like that movie. I would prefer some variety. She loves all of Steven Soderbergh's Oceans movies, mm-hmm. and liked the Uncharted movie with Tom Holland.
Yeah,
recently spent a week watching all 5 Indiana Jones films. She really liked The Last Crusade, but was not impressed with the rest. Other favorite films of hers include The Philadelphia Story, Topper,
yeah.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and Clue. Well, everybody likes Clue.
Everyone who counts,
She jokes that her dream job is to be a mid-century corporate secretary, as befits her overall aesthetic. So we watched The Desk Set, which was a hit, and The Apartment, which she said was too sad. Any fun, lighthearted movie ideas for us? Thanks for letting me exploit your valuable and professional expertise like this. Love the podcast. Pax.
This is why we became film critics.
Yeah. Oh no, you're asking film critics for film recommendations. How dare you take up our time in such a frivolous way, he said sarcastically.
There's the criteria, and there's a bunch here, we're not going to find a film that fits everything, was nothing dark or depressing, perfectly fine. Heists are good, archaeology-type adventures are good, Indiana Jones-esque films, madcap mysteries, And also looks like we got some like older kind of screwball comedy type stuff.
So what I'm hearing here is the word caper. Your partner likes caper movies. So let's think of like good caper films. Like what are some good
One of my favorites.
Heists, but not just heists, like maybe scams or plundering or just but fun. Lighthearted.
But fun. One of my favorites is a film from the 1960s. I can't remember the exact year. But it stars Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole. And it's called How to Steal a Million. Audrey Hepburn is the daughter of an art forger who has just forged a Botticelli statue. And he's very proud that it's going to be put in a museum as if it was the real thing. But after the museum carts it away, they say, oh, and we're going to have it authenticated. And he's like, oh, shit. So Audrey Hepburn has to steal it from the museum before it's authenticated. And she ends up enlisting a cat burglar, played by Peter O'Toole, who comes up with a really ingenious scheme. And it's a lot of fun. They have great romantic chemistry. It's very witty. And I just love that movie to pieces. And I don't think it gets talked about enough. So I would highly recommend that to start with.
Yeah. I remember watching a lot of sort of lighthearted caper movies when I was a kid. And there was sort of a powerful but miniature wave of these kinds of caper movies that were hits in like the late 80s. Sure. I'm thinking of films like Romancing the Stone. We've talked about that one a lot.
Yeah, great movie.
You would like Romancing the Stone.
Oh, you would.
It's incredibly crass, but it's still one of the funniest comedies I've ever seen. But A Fish Called Wanda is really fantastic. It's about a heist and the double crossings that take place after the heist and how everybody's just sort of hilariously conniving.
It's really, really funny, but if you're really, really, really want light, there's like jokes about like attempted murders in here, and that might be a little dark on that note.
That's true.
I think it's riding the edge, but if you thought, and The Apartment, I grant you, actually is kind of depressing because it actually is about like real emotional trauma and people do try to take their own lives in it. Like it's ultimately uplifting, but you have to get somewhere. But I feel like the jokes in Fish Called Wanda are dark, but in a more comical Monty Python-ish kind of way.
Like, yeah, there's a subplot about how the heisters ran into a witness, and Michael Palin, who's kind of like a bumbling character of the heisting team, has been assigned to assassinate the witness, but he can't do it. He keeps failing in these hilarious ways and ends up doing more harm that actually like hurts his feelings more than it hurts anybody else. I don't want to describe any more of that subplot. Year, though, is a movie I watched over and over again that's a con job movie called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Oh, that's a fun
which
one.
Yeah. That one was really popular. Probably know about that one. But that's with Steve Martin and Michael Caine as a rival con men who try... discover that they are both con men, discover that they're both sort of in the same game, and then make a bet, like, who can con the most money out of this one mark that they've chosen together, and she's played by Glenn Headey, and, or Glenn...
Headley. Headley, yeah.
And
that's
she...
Headley!
Glenn Headey is wonderful, by the way. She's just in general, but she's particularly good in that movie.
Yeah.
And, that's also, like, really broad and bright and kind of slapsticky, but also about... capers and crimes and trying to get away with stuff.
Maybe a little less farcical, but a fun and sexy, I think, crime caper movie is... I don't know if you haven't seen this or if you just didn't like it as much as I did, but the remake of The Thomas Crown Affair with Pierce Brosnan and
Rene
Russo.
You're very keen on this one.
I think it's really good.
It's fine.
I think it's really good.
I think it's fine. Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful bit of escapist, sexy crime entertainment. The original with Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway, I think, has aged kind of weirdly, even just in the basic premise, because it's about, like, a rich guy who does crimes for the kicks. But in the original, he, like, does bank robberies, so there's, like, this element of violence. But in the remake, he's an art thief, and there's something kind of romantic about that. And then Rene Russo is the person who's trying to, like, track him down and get him to get the painting back and everything, and she ends up falling for him, and they have sex. like you wouldn't believe, and it ends in a really, really great sequence. It's a lot of fun. I think it's pretty sexy, and I think it's underappreciated. I feel if you want to go back to the 1950s, you want to combine capers and comedies. Go back to some of the Ealing comedies.
Yeah, in I was just about to mention Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Kind Hearts and Coronets is a great. It's basically like a screwball version of Saltburn, but all of the rich people are played by Sir Alec Guinness, which is really great. I'm also very fond of the Lavender Hill Mob, which is about this this guy who's been protecting gold transfers from one bank to another for so many years, and he's about to like lose his job, so he figures, screw it, I'm gonna pull off the ultimate heist. And it's really, really clever, and everything goes wrong, and it's really, really funny, and I like that movie so much. It's so great.
You mentioned Clue, so I'm trying to think of like comedic noir or murder mysteries,
like kind
of
whodunits.
Probably saw the Knives Out movies.
One. It's not a whodunit, but if you want to like a throwback to that kind of era, the Hudsucker Proxy is absolutely modern screwball His Girl Friday, Philadelphia Story kind of rat-a-tat humor.
The Hudsucker Proxy, however, is like incredibly mannered. True. Like the filmmakers want you to know that they know what they're doing. They're not trying to sell a new version of a screwball comedy. They're trying to kind of sell you a heightened version of that.
But I do think it's very, very good. There's no heist in it or anything, but I do think it's very... I guess it's kind of a con, though. Yeah. Like, there's a scheme.
More recently, you might want to check out... if you haven't seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you should probably watch that one.
Sure.
A Simple Favor is a pretty wicked film that was... We both called it one of the best films of the year, and I feel like it's not talked about a lot. It's from a couple of years, like... 5 or 6 years ago. Paul Feig made it, and it's about Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick are like both moms at the same school, and their sons become friends. And the Blake Lively character is this really kind of vampish, catty, femme fatale character, and Anna Kendrick's like a little bit more shy, but she also has like a little bit of a femme fatale element to her. And it is about this weird sort of emotional, sexual interplay between those two characters after the Blake Lively character says, do me a simple favor, just look after my son. And she, Anna Kendrick starts looking after the young son, and then Blake Lively fucks off. And
just disappears off the face of the planet, yeah.
Yeah. And we're not really sure what's happening there for a long time. And then, of course, the like other wrinkles start to appear, and the things that they shared earlier that we weren't privy to. And it doesn't... It plays fair, I think. And when it doesn't play fair, it does so on purpose.
But there's a little bit of malevolence to it, because it does end up being kind of murdery and everything. But it's an interesting tone, because the things that people do or talk about are really quite dark, but the overall tone is very light. And I think that dichotomy makes it very entertaining. On a slightly different note, I think there's a film that kind of has Indiana Jonesy kind of like old school adventure vibes, but without actually being about an archaeologist. And it's Project A, starring Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung. It is a comedy arts movie in which they play, I think they're in the Coast Guard. And there's a whole thing with corruption at the seaports and everything. And it's got a great scene where Jackie Chan is like hanging off of a clock like Harold Lloyd. That's a lot of the old Jackie Chan / Sammo Hung movies. Are mostly great, except you'll watch them and it's like, oh, that's annoyingly sexist, actually, at times. And I think Project A actually holds up better than most of them in that regard. So it'll be more enjoyable, I think, than many of the others. Let's see here. Light, farcical.
There were a lot of... We talked about Romancing the Stone, but there were actually a lot of Indiana Jones knockoff movies.
Oh yeah, and they're mostly not good. The Alan Quatermain movies with not Whit Stillman.
is it Steve Ginty?
No,
he's the Gintiest. Steve Ginty, right?
It's not Ginty. It's it's gonna drive me up the wall. Richard Chamberlain. How did I do that? That's not even close. How did I do that? That's wild. Okay. You know what you should watch? If you like that kind of like Indiana Jones type adventure, a lot of like the tone of that comes from Swashbucklers. And I think you can get a lot of that adventure.
Captain Blood. Yeah,
Captain Blood is a great one. the either of the Mark of Zorros, the silent one, or the one with Tyrone Power, are wonderful. The Mask of Zorro is really, really great as well. You probably have heard of that one. I'm sure you've probably seen it, but if you haven't, make the time. It's a delight. Richard Lester, with Richard Chamberlain and Oliver Reed and Christopher Lee and Charlton Heston, a really fantastic cast, did an adaptation of The Three Musketeers in the 1930s, which is just sexy, funny, adventurous sword fight and fun. Like, it's a really, really good one. The sequel, The Four Musketeers, isn't quite as good, but it's still good. But definitely see that Three Musketeers. That's a great movie. I love that movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can go on. I hope that's a good start. But let us know what you see. If you see any of these, and let us know what you think. I hope it works out.
Yeah, if our recommendations took.
Yeah. No, be just very curious to see how it all turned out. So please let us know. All right. And I think that's it for the physical mail.
That's it for the physical mail, but we still have plenty of emails. Here is an email from Danny. Hello, Danny. It says, hello, Mr. and Mr. Long-time listener, first-time Patreon subscriber. Oh, thank you. Bless you.
Thank you.
We love our Patreon subscribers. You guys have provided me so much podcast material in the last 2 years. I've been listening. I thought I could at least offer some small repayment via Patreon. Well, thank you.
That's very kind. Thank you.
We're happy to provide.
Yes.
In 2024, I've been making an effort to watch more classic movies outside the usual canon. Living in the UK, thankfully, the BBC has practically every RKO picture ever made, so I just pick one at random and go with it.
Nice.
So far, my experiment is successful, mainly because they have so many Cary Grant rom-coms, and I am madly in love with him.
Who isn't?
More so, onto my question, I'm newly introduced to Fred Astaire. And though I've only watched two films of his so far, Top Hat and Easter Parade, I can't say I really care for his style. So if you have any recommendations on Fred Astaire films that might change my mind, I'd be ever so grateful. Alternatively, I'm also new to Gene Kelly when he's not singing in the rain. So if you have any other Gene Kelly musicals I should watch, I'm hardly going to say no. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your podcasts. And if you haven't had any already, drink some water. Signed, Danny.
Thank you. I know I cough a lot lately. It's allergy season. I gotta be honest, if you're not charmed by Fred Astaire and Top Hat, you might not be charmed by Fred Astaire.
Yeah, I was gonna say Top Hat's like my favorite one, so...
It's definitely up there. Yeah.
Well, here's the way I heard it said by people who, like, are real dancers, because I'm not a dancer, I only know dancing through movies. My mom, however, was a professional dancer, and she pointed out to me that Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire were kind of like... at the two opposite ends of the dance spectrum when it came to men dancing on screen. Gene Kelly was a very fluid, muscular dancer. He did a lot of leaps. He was very, very about body strength and lifts. He was a lot more balletic a dancer, whereas Fred Astaire was a lot sharper and more spindly, and not just his physique. Like, he actually was more about... virtuosity in his tap dancing. There's a reason why he notoriously just practiced and practiced until his feet bled. He and Ginger Rogers just had to make sure everything was perfect. So one was a little bit more about fluidity and natural movements, and the other was more about clipped, rehearsed virtuosity. I like both. I think I prefer Fred Astaire. If you didn't like Top Hat, watch Swing Time. And if Top Hat and Swing Time don't get you, then I can't say, I don't know what to say.
I would say, I would add The Gay Divorcee to that. I think I actually prefer The Gay Divorcee to Swing Time, but those are kind of the three. There's definitely a lot of highlights in any of his stuff with Ginger Rogers. They have a dance in the movie Roberta, which makes the tragic mistake of not being about them. They're actually supporting... in many ways in that film. But they have a dance in that movie that is maybe not their most virtuosic, but it's just delightful. It's just such a... It's one of my favorite dance acting I've seen.
I should point out that if you're going to see Swing Time, this is really unfortunate. The most impressive dance in the movie, the Bojangles number.
Yeah.
There's a bit where Fred Astaire is dancing on stage with three... shadows, like they're projecting three lights at him, and there's shadows up on the screen, and then you realize at one point that the shadows are actually pre-recorded films of him, and the shadows fall out of sync with the Fred Astaire on stage, and you think it's a mistake at one point, but then the shadows get mad because the live Fred Astaire has outdanced them. It's brilliant choreography. And you're going to be distracted by all of that choreography because Fred Astaire is in blackface.
Yeah.
It was 1934. That was considered acceptable by mainstream studios at the time.
Yeah.
So it is a detail that, rather unfortunately, you're going to have to look at.
Yeah.
If it's too tasteless to you, I'm not going to force you to watch it.
Well, that's just if you explore a lot of older movies. You're going to find that a lot of them don't address race in any single way, and you'll be able to, okay, well, I've avoided dealing with attitudes of the time, but eventually it's going to come up if you keep looking. And the ones that tend to have aged well that we keep talking about a lot are the ones that tend to be less offensive, but there are exceptions to even that rule. If you look at the original Holiday Inn, which is considered a classic, there's a blackface number in that as well. And I remember I was working at a video store around Christmas time, and it was a corporate video store, and they gave us a list of films that it was okay to put on the big TV in the back of the store, and Holiday Inn was on it, and I had to explain why we weren't going to be doing that. I don't know who the hell made up that list, but they were fools. They were wrong to do it.
I think if you're going to sit down and watch Swing Time with sort of the understanding of what you're going to see, then you'll be able to watch it in the context of the movie.
Yeah.
You put that on, like, in the background of a video store and somebody wanders in and they don't know what it is, it's just going to be fucking offensive.
Oh, yeah. It is offensive. Yeah. There's no reason to call it anything else, but they didn't sign up for that, and there's no reason really to project it to random people. It's something you would want to choose to watch. On the topic of Gene Kelly, however, I think we need to get into that. Gene Kelly is... I prefer Gene Kelly to Fred Astaire, if I had to pick.
Okay.
He is sex on legs. And I think he's done some really, really wonderful films. I am particularly fond of... well, obviously, Singin' in the Rain. Everyone loves Singin' in the Rain. There's a great one he did called It's Always Fair Weather, in which he has a sequence on roller skates that will knock your socks off. Like, it's like watching Mad Max Fury Road, but on roller skates. It's like, how did he not die just practicing this? It's really incredible. Big fan of that. The Pirate is a film I haven't seen in its entirety in a really long time, but I remember loving it. So there's a caveat there. Maybe it's not as good as I remember. He actually also starred in a Three Musketeers movie. I think he played D'Artagnan in 1948. So that might be worth checking out. I haven't watched that in many years. But that's with, like, him
from
and
what I understand,
Lana,
that
and Lana
was,
Turner.
Yeah, I understand that was, like, one of the few times he did fight choreography.
Yeah, but he did it like a dancer.
Like dance choreography.
There's a lot of tumbling, so it's really, really fun. So I would recommend that. The one I would say, and we learned this the hard way when we covered it on our Patreon, it won Best Picture, and it is not good. Is An American in Paris.
Yeah, An American in Paris just doesn't ever take off. There's, like, a few fun dance moments, but that movie's just death.
Well, the problem is...
I greatly preferred another movie that he made in the mid-40s called Anchors Away.
Yeah, Anchors Away is fun, yeah. But to the point, if you're wondering why don't we like An American in Paris, because it's, like, it's a handsome production and everything. The story is really creepy. It is about Fred Astaire, and I forget who the other guy is. And,
oh, wait, I'm sorry, it wasn't Anchors Away. I was thinking of On the Town.
On the Town, yes, On the Town.
I mixed up those movies.
I actually like Anchors Away, but On the Town is good, too. But An American in Paris is about two guys, like, fighting to romance an underage girl. Like, it's really, really... And they're open about it. It's not, like, subtext. Like, no. It's wrong. It's a wrong movie. I don't understand why we don't talk about that more when we talk about that movie, because it's just gross to watch. So I wouldn't recommend that one, except for the dancing, which is good. But you might not enjoy that movie as much as you might expect. Mm.
Did you ever see Hello, Dolly?
I did see Hello, Dolly. He directed that one, yeah.
Yeah. He directed that one.
It's a good film. It's really overblown, which is what part of the problem. It almost bankrupted the studio. But it's really good. The only problem is that we're supposed to believe that Barbara Streisand and Walter Matthau have some kind of romantic chemistry, and they don't. They really don't.
Yeah.
I think they hated each other, actually, is what I heard. So it comes across.
And his last movie, because Gene Kelly died in, like, the, like, 96, 97.
Mm. But he retired years earlier.
He retired already, but he did come back for one last film in 1997, mm-hmm. a film that I'm very fond of. He was the dance like collaborator and choreographer for the animated characters in a film called Cats Don't Dance.
Yeah.
Which is this sort of showbiz fable about anthropomorphic animals who are trying to break into the Hollywood system, but the Hollywood system is racist against animal performers, so they get only like cheap supporting roles as opposed to like the human stars who are all just horrible monsters. And there's a lot, and there's just like singing and dancing. It's like an old-fashioned 1930s musical, but in 90s animation style. And Gene Kelly oversaw the dancing. Like, he choreographed the animated characters. So I think that's an interesting way to see kind of his legacy live on, even after many years after he retired.
I really need to see that movie. I was actually just the director of the new animated Garfield movie that's coming out as of recording this week. He directed Cats Don't Dance.
Oh, wait, Garfield is Mark Dindal?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Oh, now I'm more excited to see Garfield.
Yeah, He worked on The Emperor's New Groove. He did Chicken Little. Mm-hmm. Like, he hasn't actually directed a movie since Chicken Little. It's been a long time. But, But, so I was writing about that movie. I did my review, and I was like, oh, he did Cats Don't Dance. Why haven't I seen that? That hits all of my buttons. 90s animation plus Gene Kelly plus musicals. Like, what is wrong with me that I haven't seen that movie? So I need to get around to it. But anyway, I hope that helps. And again, you're under no obligation to like something just because history says it was good. There's a lot of things that, you know, maybe they are good, but they don't have to appeal to you. And if you gave Fred Astaire a couple of movies and you gave him some of the good ones, perfectly reasonable to say, I'm not really into him and not really seek out his films. But if you want to give him another chance, I recommended The Gay Divorcee. And which one did you recommend?
Swing Time.
Yeah. Give those a try.
Or Follow the Fleet. Any of the big Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies where with both Fred and Ginger just sort of in the mid-30s.
Yeah.
Most of those are probably going to push your buttons. If they don't, then they're not going to be for you.
It might not be for you, and that's totally okay. There's no shame in it. All right, what do we got next?
Here's a letter from Landon. Hello, Landon.
Hello, Landon.
And it starts with, Mom and Dad, stop fighting. but seriously, this is on in reference to a conversation William and I had about AI following our review of Late Night with the Devil. Because Late Night with the Devil is a recent horror film, was made for very little money, and there were a few interstitial, like, it's taking place in the 70s, and there's these interstitial TV bumpers, like the We'll Be Right Back cards, that were created using automatic image generators.
Yeah.
I hate calling it AI art because it's not artificial intelligence and it's only arguably art.
No, it's generative plagiarism.
It's generated, generated images. Yeah. And I'll give some context in a minute, but I'll read the letter first. It says, seriously, I'm more on Bib's side of the issue. It feels like Skynet will be taking over soon. Late Night with the Devil rules regardless. Cool period accurate practical effects with the worms. Love the ending. It's streaming on Shudder. I recommend horror fans check it out. To add a little bit more context, I defended Late Night with the Devil and its use of AI in our review. And I was thinking only of... I was trying to put myself on the side of an independent filmmaker.
Right.
Late Night with the Devil clearly had a lot of trouble getting made merely because it was put together by so many studios. And I felt it was, like, okay for them to cut a corner.
Mm.
And I went home and I thought about that comment that I said. And I realized, wait a minute. At what budget does a film have to be before it becomes wrong?
Yeah.
And I could, there's no number in my head. You know, it's because I didn't want a big studio doing that kind of thing because that's cheap, but I was willing to be forgiving with this little independent film. I still think Late Night with the Devil rules, but I do take exception to their use of AI and I actually kind of changed my tune after we had our conversation.
Like within 12 hours. Like I had just published
I texted the next morning. I'm like, wait a minute. No, this is. And I was thinking of actually one of my very favorite radio dramas. I'm very fond of this science fiction radio drama that was made in the late 80s called Ruby 3. It's about a science fiction detective on a distant planet. And one of the stories is it takes place in essentially a living mall, and the more people consume, the bigger the mall gets, and it's like just growing over the surface of the planet. Mm. And one of the things that keeps people kind of hypnotized are these automatically generated images up on these big screens. The computer mind is essentially just creating fashion, and people are trying to chase whatever this algorithm is. And, you know, in a science fiction story, that's kind of cool, but it's meant to be dystopian. The whole point of that is that it's dystopian. Yeah. And I started to think there's no version of the proliferation of automatically generated images that is not dystopian.
Yeah.
Letting the machines take over artistic endeavors is just a way to replace humanity, isn't it? And that's gross.
And that's on top of other dangers, like being able to falsify reality. You know, if they finally work out the kinks and like, so they make it so like it's harder to tell if the, like the hands are wrong or whatever. Do we really want it to be that easy to create lies, convincing lies? Yeah. It's hard enough.
And propaganda, you can just, if anybody can do anything, then there's no trust in any image anywhere.
Right.
There's no way society doesn't break down if we hand over all of our images to automatic image generators.
Now, and the thing is that I know we sound old right now, because there's always that element of older generation, there's a new technology that comes along. This isn't actually that new, but the proliferation and the scope of it is. A new technology comes along, and old people are like, no, I don't know about these 8-track tapes. I prefer vinyl, that kind of thing. And there's always an element of that, and I acknowledge that. But I will say this. I think this is different for a variety of reasons. And the main reason is because, yeah, I'm not saying there's no practical application for this technology. Someone was talking about how in Furiosa, the upcoming Mad Max Fury Road prequel, they used AI technology, but in a novel way, in which there's a young actress playing Furiosa, and Anya Taylor-Joy, who plays her as an adult, they used AI to sort of combine their faces a little bit so that the younger actor actually looked like Anya Taylor-Joy. Apparently she didn't. And that's interesting, and that's something that they created to enhance something human beings were already doing. It's a visual effect they would have done anyway, but they found a way to do it with new technology. New technology to create visual effects is not in and of itself a bad thing. The problem is when it's used to remove people from the equation. When it's removing people, not just artistically is bad enough, but also economically. People are trying to not just use AI in order to solve complex problems. They're actually using AI to, hey, let's put all voice actors out of business. Hey, let's put all production designers.
That's the worst part of it.
We're writers, so that's particularly pointed to us. But regardless, you're taking away en masse all at once a huge swath of the economy, ostensibly to save money so you can make products. But people can't afford to buy those products if you take away all their jobs. So that's something that we actually need to think about. And it's something that Google has just did, because Google has decided that they want to be Star Trek. And you know how in Star Trek, you're just standing in your room and you say, computer, play classical jazz, or computer, how tall is Mount Whitney? I don't know, whatever. And the computer just answers. And they're like, well, isn't that the way it should work? And I'm like, if no one has to make any money off of writing and researching these things, yes. But in Star Trek, they don't. And in reality, they do. So if Google has implemented a new technology wherein if you put in a prompt or ask it a question, most times it comes up with an AI answer. And that AI answer is scraped from web pages from people who actually did the work, except now they won't get the traffic. And also now, a lot of the time, it's inaccurate because they didn't know what they were doing. Yeah, it's threatening the whole economy. It's worse though, because now it's like they won't even search the web unless you actually choose that option.
It's really dangerous to the whole online publishing economy. And I'll say this: I use Bing. It's better than Google. But even that's got
AI stuff in it. The one I've heard is actually pretty good. DuckDuckGo, but I haven't actually had a chance to do a lot of fiddling. Yeah.
I turned off the AI searches on Bing.
So you can turn them off on Bing, because Google, they won't let you turn them off.
Yeah, you can. There's an option. You can just say, don't do that, and it won't do that.
Bing anymore. It is, for now. But
So I mean, they're not a sponsor, just I use Bing, and it's because it's better than all the other ones I've run.
For now. We'll see how it goes.
For now, yeah, we'll see how it holds out. I'll say this about automatically generated images. I am still sort of fascinated by the artistic potential of the concept art behind the machines. For instance, a lot of people will take pictures of, an old board game box or, some vintage painting that they find at a thrift store. We don't even know what it is, and they'll post it on, Instagram or something. And some people are doing that and using the image generators to create these kind of creepy amalgams of, old board game art to create these kind of twisted versions. Like, let's pull on Grandma's nerve ends, whatever it is. These kind of twisted horror versions of board games. And I find that is, because it's just amusing, and no one would be getting royalties for those, that old box art anyway. And so you're not stiffing anybody out of money.
I think...
Nobody knows who the photographer is, so you're not stiffing anybody out of credit. It belongs to a corporation, so I'm okay with that.
There's a gray area there.
It creates this weird kind of uncanny visuals that I find really eerie, and I find it really eerie because there's no human hand involved. What does a computer think humans look like? And it's a little off. And that can be an interesting thought experiment.
I think there's...
When you try to sell that as the genuine article, that becomes unethical as fuck. But when you're just sort of using it casually for fun on Instagram, I'm not going to give anybody too much grief for that.
I'm not going to give anybody too much grief for that, but you are feeding the system, ultimately. That's true. It's not disconnected.
That's the one issue. If you're paying for some sort of service to do that, then you are feeding a system, and that's bad.
Oh, they're just doing it anyway. Now they're going to scrape all of Reddit basically in order to feed the system.
I guess if they're scraping whatever they got, then they're already doing it unethically.
Yeah.
Also, I think there's also a way to, because I've always been interested in the kinds of conceptual art that does try to remove a human element from it, here's a cat that paints. That's not a human artist. That's a cat. I'm not sure what a cat thinks.
Yeah.
I don't think a cat has any concept of art.
No, it's a novelty, really, more than anything else.
I've seen several art installations that are pre-programmed robots. They just say they put a paintbrush in a robot arm, and it has it kind of do just automatic random images, and that creates art that way. And that's kind of an interesting thought experiment.
Right.
I feel like these automatic generated images are just the computerized version of that.
Yeah.
And I think when we look at it, if we put it in a museum.
That's like, if it was a museum installation, I might think it was an interesting, as long as they declared what it was, or even at the end, haha, you didn't know it was AI. That might actually be an interesting sort of artistic statement in and of itself. But the problem, again, is when you're using it to replace people doing legitimate craft, and that's really dangerous. I think there is definitely uses for the technology, but it tends to be when there's a limited data set that you can control. They used some AI software, generative software, when they made the most recent Spider-Man Spider-Verse movie that was basically doing things like we have a data set that shows when the character is talking, their dimples move a certain way. Well, rather than do that every single time personally, we've trained this thing based on our actual illustrations. That's not the same thing as not paying someone to do the art. A tool.
If something Late Night with the Devil culled those bumpers from a team of artists who had deliberately and knowledgeably fed their art into their scannable database, and that's all they were drawing from, then I have no ethical issue with that at all. The artists knew what they were getting into. Presumably they were being paid.
Exactly.
And they agreed to have their art remixed by the machine.
But the problem is they were cut out of the process and they weren't paid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I feel like if you want to do that with public domain images, I guess you can have at it.
I guess that's fair.
In the public domain.
Technically that's fair game,
And if you are an artist and you are 100% cognizant of what's going on and you get a little bit of money to feed your own art into a database because you don't mind, then that's your prerogative as an artist.
Choice.
You can do that if you want.
But don't forget, you can't copyright what AI creates.
Exactly. You get a one-time payment and you're not going to get any royalties, and you understand that and all of that. If all that's communicated to you clearly and you're okay with that, then I think those are the only ethical ways you can use these automatic image generators to create some kind of art for a commercial product.
I think
everything else is off the table.
We are in an inflection point, and we are deciding, and the technology is moving. It's not that the technology is moving fast so much as that companies are, because it's the new hotness. It's the new Bitcoin. Yeah, it's the new 3D. People are just desperate to throw this. This package of onions was packaged with AI. It's the kind of thing I'd half expect to see. As if that's going to be a selling point. Like, ooh, no humans. We're going to find this conversation evolving, and I would not be surprised if in a year from now, 2 years from now, you and I are having this exact same conversation and having and talking about different talking points. Because we're going to see what these things are being used, or we're going to see what the actual non-hypothetical impact is of what Google is doing to the online economy. So we'll see how it goes. I'm deeply concerned about how everyone wants to jump in the deep end of this and not actually think about what it's going to do to people, their careers, and really the industries as a whole. So sorry we fought. Whitney realized he was wrong. And we're done.
I did.
You know, and we added a note to the episode saying, hey, we had this argument. We didn't come to a conclusion at the end. But literally, the next morning, Whitney was like, I thought it over. I talked it out. Put a note on it. So I did.
Yeah, well, a big deciding factor was I saw a TV commercial for, like, Facebook's, like, automatic art art making machine, whatever it's called, and it like was advertising the service that you could like you could use it with your kids, and you can tell a story, and it'll make pictures for the story for you, and it's just something you do for fun. It's like, wait a minute, that's not something you just do for fun. This is a dystopian nightmare where you're asking a computer to like rip off other people's art for you, and this is like being sold as this pleasant 1950s utopian ideal. It's like, no, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to have any of this. I was totally wrong about what I said.
In what utopia, fictional or just imaginary, like whatever you want to call it, did we do away with art?
Yeah.
Like a utopian society where, thank God, everything is automated, especially the art. So now you don't have to create art, nor have anything conveyed to you that wasn't already conveyed in the past. Nothing new, just recycled, very safe. That does not sound like a utopia to me.
No, it's not the utopia. And I understand why so many companies are going all in on this. It's because and I've said this before, we just lived through this 10-15 year period where a lot of things that were really kind of samey were getting really, really popular. And I feel like if things weren't samey, then there would be no demand for it. And you know what? A lot of the things that were selling that were kind of samey, the big blockbusters that all have similar-looking special effects, similar-looking stories, similar types of characters, they're not as successful now.
Yeah, it's an interesting time.
They're on kind of like a very specific aesthetic is now on a downward edge of popularity. I guess the studios thought this is going to be popular in perpetuity. It's going to be popular and going to look this way forever. We may as well cut the artists out of the equation. No. They did it at the worst possible time.
Well, the thing is, it would have been bad anyway, because the thing is, people get bored with shit, and people do need new stimulus. They do need, even if it's something familiar but done in a very new way, something that no one would have predicted. That's a big part of not just art, but life. You know, you need something new. We need to expand our horizons, and we can't do that if we're only recycling. We just can't. So, but thank you for writing. Sorry we fought. I think we can move on, because this is a big conversation, and smarter people than us are having it. I recommend listening to those podcasts. I'm sure Adam Conover has said something brilliant about it.
Here is a letter from Kay. Hello, Kay.
Hey, Kay.
We know Kay. Kay says, hi, guys. I just wanted to drop a note and say that I felt the transness in I Saw the TV Glow is more than coded, but perhaps less than explicit. I think you and I you and I both love I Saw the TV Glow. Yes. And you and I both have like very, very different approaches to the material.
Yeah. And I think,
like,
and I think
how we were interpreting it.
And I think it warrants, I think there are multiple perspectives on it, but I do agree. I actually know what this letter is about, and I do agree with the premise of this email, so I'm going to let you finish.
Oh, okay. But yeah, you said that it was an explicit trans allegory. I said that it's at best kind of a subtle trans allegory. But
you also talked about how it's a film about asexuality, which is also true. And we talked about how it is a meta commentary, and whether it's positive or negative is all. It's like a lot of the great movies. It's about many things all at once. But Kay is about to drop some fucking wisdom on us. So let's just go.
Anyway, it is more than coded. The transness is more than coded, but perhaps less than explicit. You referred to Maddie as a lesbian, but I read them as having fully transitioned. They changed their name, dressed more mask or androgynous, cut their hair short, died and was born again, only to come back to attempt waking Owen out of the heavy state of disassociation and dysphoria. The only time either character smiles throughout the whole movie is when Owen tries on a dress for the first time, further relating themselves to the female lead in The Pink Opaque. That's the show within the show. Asexuality is definitely a strong and probable read of Owen, but as a trans person myself, I discovered that my sexuality changed drastically after transitioning. When I look back at the sex and attraction I explored for most of my life prior, I now view and classify the vast majority of it as various degrees of self-harm. In my experience, when you're dealing with the trauma and dysphoria, you're an empty shell devoid of any authentic personhood until the healing begins. Everything else is just misappropriating coping mechanisms for identity and personality. I think a lot of cis people are going to be confused by TV Glow, but for trans people, it's a blaring dog whistle. I cried nearly the entire duration because it felt so clear and direct, especially when it revealed the chalk text on the pavement reading, "There is still time." For anyone who is still figuring their shit out, I didn't transition until I was almost 40. There is still time, and it's never too late. K.
Yeah, I think K is spot on. I do think that all the stuff we're talking about is in there. But I think it is pretty explicitly about the trans experience. And in fact, I attended a screening of this movie with director Jane Schoenbrunn in attendance. And they talked about how a lot of the movie is kind of about... And they use the term... God, I've been trying to look this up online. I cannot find the right search terms. There's a specific term for when you realize, oh, maybe I'm not cisgender. Like, there's, like, a moment of awakening. That's not what it is.
The moment of... Realization.
Yeah, like all of a sudden, like, a hole's been punched through reality, and now you can see things clearly. A moment of clarity, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And that's kind of what a lot of the movie is about. And I think it is beautiful at illustrating that. They also talked about how, apparently... They said it was a weird phenomenon where they would show the trailer to various people of I Saw the TV Glow, and people who were trans or gender fluid, they said the trailer felt longer to them than people who were cis.
Oh.
Like, they were more deeply in tune with just the vibe of it, and just that it affected them in a very different way. And I thought that was really exciting, that a movie has that kind of power. And I really, really hope that, like, I hope the people who this movie is going to speak to directly, and I think it's a pretty wide range of people, find this movie and just see how powerful it is. And I hope people who maybe feel like they might fall outside of that range watch it as well, because if movies really are, as Ebert said, machines that generate empathy, I think I Saw the TV Glow may be the ultimate example of that, because hopefully this will put you in a headspace that is not known to you and might give you a greater understanding of what other people are going through who have identities that don't match your own. I really, really hope this... Oh, God, I fucking love this movie. I really fucking love... This is the best movie I've seen in years. I think it's so good. Anyway.
A friend of ours, Bea Peterson, she wrote a letter a while back trying to get us to think about... Because we were having a lot of conversations at the time about... what constituted a male gaze in a film and what constituted a female gaze in a film. And that's where our conversation ended. And it was Bea Peterson who said, hey, what would a non-binary gaze look like?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, something that hadn't been talked about a lot. There's not a lot of writing about the non-binary gaze. And we said at the time, what we need are actually more trans, non-gender conforming, or a gender, a non-binary artists and filmmakers who can give their perspective. And lo, we've seen a lot more non-binary filmmakers and trans filmmakers come to the fore and actually have a little bit more of a voice in the cinematic fabric. Yeah. And we've kind of seen what that looks like and what that sort of that experience looks like.
Yeah, and again, it's still a small subset. It's still a small subset, but it's a good step forward, you know?
It's a small subset, but we're finally, for the first fucking time, getting a little bit more of an artistic vocabulary as to what that looks like. And that's an exciting time to learn this new vocabulary and actually hear these voices that throughout film history were either coded, which is frustrating, or just non-existent.
And I...
Something like I saw the TV glow, I can only react to it as a cis guy, because that's who I am. But I'm interested to see these perspectives and hear them, of course, and see how I react to them is going to reveal a lot about me, I think, and my views of gender and my views of my own gender. And I'm excited to experience that as well.
Yeah.
I read the Maddie character as a lesbian character. Kay did not.
Yeah.
Kay saw Maddie as a trans character.
Yeah. And, and Kay's interpretation of the character we both interpreted as asexual, and again, I identify as asexual, as someone who had not come into their own yet, and maybe their sexuality would change as they came into a trans identity. Maybe, maybe not. I will say this, speaking as someone who, ever since I came out to myself, I was completely unaware for so many years, I have been really fascinated in just how little asexual representation is, at least overt. I think there's a lot of asexual filmmaking actually out there. I think we talk a lot about how people like modern generations are like, is sex really necessary in filmmaking? And I think that's a somewhat asexual perspective. And I think a lot of mainstream blockbusters have, there might be romance, but they've removed a lot of the sexual physicality out of a lot of our mainstream narratives. And I think there's a conversation to be had there, but I do think that I don't, by the way, I think it's a legit interpretation as well, but maybe whether or not it's more legit is irrelevant. Yeah.
I would ask this, is there a difference between asexual representation in a mainstream movie and simply a non-sexual movie?
Yes, there is. And I think that it's sort of a difference between having a movie that is a quote-unquote feminist film, wherein that is actually on the agenda, that is the purpose of it, and a movie that simply supports those ideals without actually engaging with that text. I would argue that we have very few asexual films because there are very few movies in which characters are openly asexual. And I think if you go back, you can definitely find instances of characters who, if they said they were asexual, you would be like, yes, everything about you reads that. And one of my favorite examples is Herbert West in Reanimator. Maybe not the best representation overall, but he definitely checks off a lot of my boxes. But again, we're not actively talking about it. And I think you can look at, there's a lot of movies that have the male gaze that aren't, which we refer to as a distinctly heteronormative, masculine sort of perspective, not just in narrative, but also visually.
That same ogling happens in queer film as well.
That's true. That's fair. I suppose
men ogling other men.
You're right. I probably was inaccurate to say that. But regardless, there's definitely a certain amount of ogling of what men would ogle. And if you look at films like if you look at even 50 Shades of Grey, which is not a great movie, but is directed by a woman and it is about a woman's sexuality, and just the camera angles in that movie are not what you would see in most erotic cinema directed by men. They are done from a very different eye, and I think that's very noteworthy, and I think it's exciting filmmaking in its own way. We don't get a lot of that openly with asexuality, and we're seeing more. You know, there's definitely other more characters. You know, character in BoJack Horseman is openly asexual, and that actually led to some storylines, and that was, you know, mostly good. At least in my experience, I didn't watch all of it. Yeah, that is something that is somewhat underserved, and I think as this becomes something that is more talked about in the mainstream, and I've had, people tell me that identity doesn't exist, And no, you're wrong about that. It does. But I think we're going to get, hopefully, more films explicitly from that perspective. And that might also show us a different kind of vernacular as well. But I'm really excited about all these films. And again, all makes it sound like there are hundreds. Mm. But that we're getting more mainstream, genuinely great movies about the trans experience. We've had at least two this year so far.
William, I'd like you to seek out a film that I saw a couple of years ago. It's called So Pretty.
Okay.
And that just it's about just sort of this enclave of trans and non-binary people who are just sort of like living and loving and appreciating each other's bodies. It's actually very kind of mellow and laid back and conversational. There's actually not a lot of like story or dialogue. It's more just about existence.
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting sort of example of sort of trans and non-binary images and voice in filmmaking that I think didn't get talked about enough.
Thank you for telling
me. I'd love to hear your thought on that one.
Yeah, I'm sure you mentioned it at the time, but I don't have...
It was like 2019, I think, that movie came out.
Yeah, it's long enough away that I don't actually remember.
Yeah.
It is... Okay, no, wait. That's a horror movie. Here we go. 2019... Yeah, okay, that is currently it's currently on Ovid, because of course it is.
that's where I saw it. It was on Ovid.
Yeah.
Check out So Pretty, because that one's really good.
Awesome.
As for films that have the bisexual gaze, that's just any movie that makes you say, God, everyone's so hot.
Well, Whitney can say that because he's bisexual. So we're clear.
Yeah. Well, what's a good movie about the bisexual gays? Probably The Mummy from 99, just where everybody's so hot.
Oh my God, I did see So Pretty.
You saw So Pretty.
I did see So Pretty. It had kind of like a general, it's a title that could have been a million things. No, I did see this movie. It's really good. So yeah, that's okay. a good pick. Yeah. Yeah, awesome.
I recommend So Pretty. Everybody see So Pretty.
Yeah, there you go. But anyway, thank you for writing in. Thank you for, because again, a lot of art is subjective, because it is by its very, very nature, and what we get out of it isn't necessarily what the artist intentionally put in. Sometimes our perspective, me and Whitney, will differ, and we'll both be kind of... I don't think we were wrong, but I think we were also kind of off the mark in a way, because I mentioned it, but I didn't go into enough detail about it, and that was because I was focused on my own reaction, which was as a cisgender person is different, you know.
I was gonna say I can't say that we were wrong, but we can only offer a certain perspective, and that's the only way we can really put it.
And we need all the perspectives. This is why we need so many film critics and art critics of all kinds, really, so that we can view the art that we see. You know, it'd be very personal to us, but then we can also see how other people view it, and that's how we expand our horizons and our awareness of how other people feel and live. And so, I would like to thank Kay for writing in and being more clear about something that we're not able to be clear enough about, and that added perspective was incredibly invaluable. So thank you. As always, you're one of the best of us. And I think that's it for this week on We've Got Mail. And by week, I mean month. We have not been doing this. We keep doing this thing, and we need to stop doing it. We keep doing this thing where it's like, if we weren't able to get to the P.O. Box this week, because we both work and we can't always get to the post office during the day when it's open, if we can't get to it, we're like, oh, we need to wait and see if we have the physical mail. We should probably just push on sometimes. If it's going on, if it's more than like, one week late, we should just do it. So
we'll get to it.
But thank you, everybody, who wrote in. Again, if you definitely want your correspondence read on the air, send it to us in our P.O. box. We'll try to get to it more often. But regardless, we always read whatever is in our P.O. box, but we try to read everything else as we can. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. And don't forget, we're on Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to listen to our Oscars podcast, we'll listen to our Star Trek podcast. If you want to hear us do a commentary track for one of the worst movies ever made, Nuki, We just released that a couple of days ago. That was like pulling teeth. Hopefully for us, not the audience.
And we hope we can make that interesting.
Yeah. And a bunch of other stuff besides. You can vote for future episodes of things, and you get our new episodes ad-free. So thank you to all of our patrons. We can't do this without you. You mean the world to us. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And if you want to help out the show and you can't afford to join up, subscribe if you haven't already, and leave us a review. Really, really helps. I cannot stress that enough.
It pushes us up in the algorithm, and it lets the AI find us.
Damn the AI! That's that. And, of course, we're on social media at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And we're gonna go now. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.